Welcome to the Money Advantage Podcast, empowering business owners with the permission to think differently about money so that you can consciously choose to live a meaningful and fulfilled life now. Our passion is making money simple, fun, and doable, helping you feel great about your money and getting your money working for you so you can thrive.
Good morning and welcome back to the Money Advantage Podcast. This is Rachel Marshall and Bruce Wainer, and we're here this morning to have another great conversation with you about infinite banking and becoming your own banker. Let me make sure that I've got my chat open. So I would love to hear first, before we get started, if you have any specific questions about infinite banking, we would love to hear them today. Bruce, it is a pleasure to talk with you this morning and be here talking about becoming your own banker. And how are you doing this morning?
Doing great. This is this particular topic comes up quite often, and it's a little confusing at the very beginning when you look at it emotionally. But if you look at it logically and financially from the insurance company's points of view, then I think people will kind of understand why it is something that the insurance companies actually are just trying to protect not only themselves, but of course, if it's a mutual company, which we deal with, they're trying to protect all the policyholders. So I'm glad we're doing this. I'm glad that Nelson put this in the book to kind of clear things up as we get towards the end of the book.
Very much towards the end. And I always have to double check. I think we're on episode 25. I put these in a few days ago and then I forget which episode we're on. It's quite advanced in the number. I don't think we've ever done a series this long in any stretch of the imagination. And yes, we're on episode 25. But what we're looking at today is we're back in Nelson Nash's book, Becoming Your Own Banker. Unlock the Infinite Banking Concept by R. Nelson Nash. We refer to him directly as Nelson Nash as he went by. And we're on episode 25. We're nearing the end of the book. We've been going through this series to unpack each chapter, each segment of the book, and really dig into what it means. And today, the title of the chapter is What If I Am Uninsurable? And that can seem like a very scary position to be in, especially if you are saying, I love the infinite banking concept. I want to use this. I hear about how I can become my own banker, how I can take over the banking function, how I can use this capital during my lifetime to put myself in a position of control, to be like a bank by setting up this entity and setting up this structure. Now I can earn dividends and interest and reap those rewards on an exponential, compounding, uninterrupted basis that gives me tremendous growth through interest and dividends, and also allows me to have this death benefit that I can pass on to my kids and grandkids and create this legacy with. There's just so many potentials and so much capacity for supercharging and energizing your financial life. And then sometimes we feel like we hit this complete roadblock where the stop sign is right in front of us and it says, oh no, your health is not good enough to qualify for life insurance. What do I do next? And as we were getting ready to do this episode, I had a little bit of fun with the title because we don't normally talk about hacks. And I think that the whole word hack can be a negative term, I think, in a lot of ways, because so many people are looking for a hack to do something rather than an actual system or a process to implement something powerful in their life. And so the reason we use this term is that I want you to know that there are ways to use infinite banking, even if you have a medical condition or something that prevents you personally from being insured. So we're also not really talking about hacks. We're talking about how to use the infinite banking concept, even if you are not personally insurable. So again, I'm super thankful Nelson put this in the book, as you mentioned, Bruce, as well. And I'm thankful that he talks about all of the ways that you still can use infinite banking and really make this a tool for anyone to be able to use.
Yeah, I think the first thing we need to address is something that is related to the topic, but Nelson doesn't address it, is the fact that I hear this all the time where a person says, I'm not insurable. They've already decided on themselves that they're not insurable. And those are people we talk to. I mean, there's probably a lot of people that don't even call us because they think they're not insurable. And the common things that people will say to me is, well, I'm on a blood pressure medicine. I'm on cholesterol medicine. I weigh about 20 or 30 pounds too much. An insurance company is not going to cover me. And what's interesting is I say this to clients all the time. Yeah, I understand why you think that, because obviously a doctor probably put them on those medications and gave them the grave consequences if they did not go on those medications. However, insurance companies actually like it when you're taking care of your health. So if there's something basic like high cholesterol, blood pressure medication, thyroid medication, things that are kind of basic to your health that can be controlled easily with some medication, insurance companies actually don't even ding you for that. As a matter of fact, they actually like it. Consequently, we've had people who haven't gone to the doctor for 20 or 30 years, and they actually do not like that more than they like people that are taking medication, because you do not take your health seriously in their eyes. You may be perfectly healthy. You may even say to yourself, well, I'm perfectly healthy. I don't need to go to the doctor. But those kind of things come with what they call silent killers, things that could kill you that you don't even know and are building up and then are become irreversible. So if you're a listener out there and you're saying, well, I have these conditions, I'm not going to be insurable. Nelson doesn't talk about that in his book. He just talks about when you find out you're not insurable. But a lot of people already pre-qualify themselves from that situation. Now, the nice thing about it is that because we have really good relationships with home offices at a couple different insurance companies, I can actually just take your preliminary health situation and send it to the underwriter without having you go into formal underwriting, doing an application.
They like a test. You're basically just communicating with like them ahead of the application.
Right. And I just simply say, hey, I won't say their names, you know, but this is the situation. I just did it twice this week. 70-year-old woman, pre-diabetic medication, CPAP machine, and I forgot there was one other. And he came back and said, and you got to understand, these are pre-qualifications, just like when you get you're pre-qualified for a credit card in the mail. They are not offers. But they will say, based upon the information you gave us, we believe that this person would get an offer. Now, that offer may be a below standard offer, but that's okay. A lot of people get all bent out of shape about below standard offers, but that just simply means that they believe there may be slightly less than true mortality, or that it may be that, hey, we just need additional information from your doctors, and you can still get a standard or an above standard situation. We had another person this week that actually had heart conditions that they had done. And I sent them the preliminary information, and they said to me, everything on here would not disqualify them. However, we would like to see this test and this test, because that would have been ordered also in a situation like that. Can you reach out to the client to see if they actually have those tests or the ability to get those tests? And I did, and that client was perfectly okay. Yes, I do believe I had those tests. I will reach out to my doctor for clarification. So don't pre-qualify. The moral of the story is don't pre-qualify your own health because what you believe is bad may not be bad to the life insurance companies.
Bruce, I love that you shared that because, I mean, if you're listening, you might be like me who I prefer and tend towards non-traditional medicine. I tend to, if we have a cold in the house, we're going to do echinacea and lysine and vitamin C. We're going to do all the herbs and the supplements rather than going to the doctor for that. But at the same time, I think any person who is being responsible and taking care of their health does still need to have that ongoing physician. You need a primary care physician. You need to have an ongoing relationship, because it is very difficult to go to a life insurance company and try to get underwriting when they're going to look back at your medical records and you have no history for 20 years. I mean, that's just going to be a really challenging situation, because they're going to need to see some kind of a track record, some kind of a documentation to go back and base their decisions on. And so I just wanted to speak to that real quickly. And then Bruce, I think for the sake of this discussion, especially if somebody is newer to the idea of infinite banking and specifically life insurance, can you explain, I think these would be really helpful. First, what is the range of ratings that you'll see with a typical company, from super preferred down to what a table rating is? So can you explain that? And then let's talk about what the actual definition of uninsurability is.
Yeah, great question. So first of all, if you think about people's health and their ability to get life insurance from an insurance company, the life insurance company is going to rate you based upon mortality scales of the general public that's trying to get life insurance. And it's no different than most things in our life. It's basically a bell curve. So there's very few super healthy people on one side of the bell curve. The bell curve then goes, as we all know, in the shape of a bell. And then on the far other side of the curve, there would be people that are not healthy, and the insurance company will not even give them an offer. And there's a big range between those two people. And so typically insurance companies have their standard rating. And when we actually talk to people about the benefits of infinite banking using specially designed whole life insurance contracts, we tell them, and we run illustrations based upon standard ratings, because most of the population, even if you feel really healthy yourself, actually fall into the standard rating. Standard does not mean you're unhealthy or you're of average health. It just means that that is the rating that most people get when they're applying for life insurance. That is what the mortality tables cost basis is based upon. Then
Bruce, one thing that I think you've brought up before that's helpful to notice is that you might be of exactly average health according to the American population, but not the entire American population will apply for life insurance. And so a standard rating basically means the average of those who are applying, or correct, of those who are getting insurance. Correct.
Correct. You got to think about yourself as if your average of the general population, but a lot of the general population that already has major health concerns are not even going to apply for life insurance. So you're actually healthier than the population that is looking for life insurance. Mm-hmm. So just think about that. Now, there are two, in most insurance companies, there are two categories ahead of the average, which they call standard. And that is, now they all call them slightly different things, but this one, the ones that we generally work with, call it preferred and super preferred. If you're super preferred, you're way out on the far end of the bell curve. You know, you have your perfect health, height and weight. You have no real blood markers that are different than anybody else. You don't do, and Rachel, I guess I should have brought this up too. Ratings also depend not only on your health, your gender, because average for or standard for a woman is going to be different than standard for a man, but it also includes your habits. Now, a lot of people think, well, habit, you know, drinking, smoking, you know, those kind of things. Well, yeah, but they actually include other things like skydiving, motorcycle riding, scuba diving, traveling to places that are not the safest in the world, first responder and military service. So
again, let's be clear. Those things don't disqualify you from life insurance, but they would increase the, in the insurance's mind, the likelihood of mortality, which then would rate you lower than your pure health would indicate.
Correct. So example, you may be of super preferred health, really, really good health. However, you are, you actually ride a motorcycle. And so they may actually say, according to your health, you're super preferred, but according to your habits, we're going to make you standard rating. And what standard rating does is that is the baseline. So when you move up to a preferred, mostly it affects the amount of death benefit. It really doesn't affect your cash value that much. It affects how much death benefit you get. So I'm making these numbers up, but let's say we have a 50-year-old and they put a certain amount of money in and they get $500,000 of death benefit for that particular amount of money. If you move up to preferred, your cash value may be very similar, maybe slightly higher, but your now your death benefit goes from $500,000 to $550,000. If you move up to super preferred, the cash value will grow very, very slightly according to the standard and the preferred, but now it might go up another $50,000. So standard would be $500,000, but if you're super preferred, you get a death benefit of $600,000. So it really affects the death benefit more than it affects the cash value. It does affect the cash value somewhat, but it really affects the death benefit. And so consequent.
Just a question on that. So would that be why there would be a perception that having health concerns increases your cost of insurance?
Well, that's, it does increase your cost of insurance. And that's where I was going. On that side of the ledger, it actually allows you to get a lot more death benefit relative to the other side of the ledger. So as we go in the other direction, once again, the cost of the insurance, obviously you're closer to mortality. Instead of them saying, we're just going to charge you more, thus affecting your cash value, what they're going to do is they're just going to lower the death benefit. Now, they have to say within modified endowment contract guidelines, the 7-pay test for the MEC limits. But so example, if you get rated, now insurance companies rate you differently and they call it substandard or below standard. So some use a alphabet system where they go, the first substandard rating is A, the second is B, and it goes all the way to E. I don't think there's any past E for most companies. Or other companies may use a numerical system where they say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Now, even there, once again, the cash value is not as affected as much as the death benefit. Now, once you get past the fourth rating, and in some cases, the second rating, in other words, A, B, C, or 1, 2, 3, 4, so your substandard 4 or substandard C, then the insurance companies can do one of two things. They can either not allow you to put PUAs on the contract, or they will give you an additional cost of the insurance for adding the PUAs and the term onto the cash value. So in that situation, the cash value will be affected because of the additional premium that is caused by that substandard rating. But it still is not a lot. It doesn't make it where the cash value is really, really low, but it does affect it. For clarity here, it does affect it at that time.
That's another reason why Nelson didn't always use the same exact split or ratio between base and paid-up additions, which he brings up later in this chapter, as we'll point out. But Bruce, you said last week, I think it was, that we were talking about this, that Nelson didn't always use the same exact funding structure for every policy. And part of that is because there's different circumstances going into you getting a policy, and a different policy design or structure of base and PUA might be necessary to achieve the best outcomes for you.
So before we get into this very much further, Fritz is asking, is there any evidence to show that persons who took the COVID shot are not given a standard rating? Where I'm from, they issued a form of customers taking policies to verify they took it. So, Fritz, that's a good question. And I just like to be very transparent. I am actually for vaccines. And then I ran into this during the COVID situation where people had a mistrust. And so I actually did ask the insurance companies at the time whether that was going to affect it. And there was a very short period of time that some insurance companies actually required evidence of a COVID shot. Okay. But I want to make this very clear. There was rumors out there all the time that you were not going to be insurable from the insurance company's perspective from taking the, at least in the United States, if you took the COVID shot vaccine, that you would not be insurable or you wouldn't be insurable for 5 years. That was nothing but rumor, especially with at least 8 of the mutual companies that I did research with. And they were the major mutual companies that I did research with. So they actually see the COVID vaccination as being a positive, not a negative, as many media outlets would have and have said that it was, and mainly because it got emergency authorization to be used. And people were saying that if it got emergency authorization to be used, it wasn't actually a valid vaccine, and insurance companies were going to use that not to insure people. Or even a worse rumor was that if you took the shot, your current contract would be null and void. And that is absolutely an impossibility. Once you take or pass a insurance application and get a rating and put the contract in place, you become part of the mortality, which they know that some people are going to change their habits.
Yeah, like starting motorcycle riding after you have the policy, right?
Or take up scuba diving afterwards, or get into the military afterwards. But they also know, as a law of large numbers, what else is going to happen?
Some people are going to quit those habits.
Yeah, people are going to stop riding motorcycles. People are going to stop going to scuba diving. People are going to lose weight. They're actually going to get healthier. So that's what the law of large numbers does. And it is a contract. And Nelson used to say this all the time, and I want people to listen to this. Because people are all the time trying to scare people into actually doing applications with Rachel. You know, that's your and I's. We do not do that. But Nelson used to say that this is a contract. And people would say, yeah, but the IRS could change. They could change the fact that it's no longer tax deferred growth, and it's no longer, you can't access this tax free. And Nelson says, could they? Because he detested Congress in general. However, if they did that, it would actually change contract law, which is the basis of all civilized societies. And he says, if that would happen, we have more problems than whether insurance is tax free or not. Because now we've actually taken any contract, whether it's to buy your house, whether it's to an employment contract, whether it is to buy a car, those would all have precedence to be now null and void.
All loans. And I mean, we would have fragmenting of so much of society.
And let me address one more thing that Fritz brought up.
Well, on the contract, though, if they did change contract law, would it be more likely? I mean, we've seen sometimes that laws do change, and usually then the old contracts would be grandfathered, so keep correct. Their status, and the law would apply to new contracts, correct?
Very good. And that has precedent over and over and over in our society and in the insurance industry.
Mm-hmm.
But over and over in our society, that has precedent where they say any contract that's in force now will stay in force the way it was written, but any contract going forward will actually have to abide by these. So yeah, great, great point, Rachel. The last thing I want to talk about as far as the vaccine is that there have been articles written about how insurance companies actually saw an increase in mortality during the COVID pandemic, and they are really hurting from a mortality expense. That is true, but mostly in stock companies. And why is that? Because the general public that has insurance through their employer is actually not close to mortality age, because most employees are not close to mortality age. That's why group insurance is the cheapest insurance that you can get, because they know that most people will be getting off of their employment and will not be taking that group insurance with them. And thus, they would have paid those premiums all those years with no future liability.
Mm-hmm.
And so
for the insurance company, they have all of this income from premiums and very little expense due correct. To payout of claims.
But during COVID, yes, there was a large portion. Oh, by the way, and the other thing about it is that those people tend to get more group insurance from work because they're not insurable outside of the group, because group insurance is guaranteed issue. Mm-hmm. You can have liver disease, you can have heart disease, you can be overweight, and they have to accept you. And so during COVID, those type of people with those extra morbidities actually died more frequently than the general population. And there were more people in the general population that died that were younger, not a lot of them, but a lot of them in the group. So yes, the mortality experience was a lot higher for those group insurance, and that did cause problems in their bottom line. However, most mutual companies are not involved with group insurance, so they really didn't see a change, a drastic change in mortality. They saw some change in mortality, but not a drastic change in mortality.
Bruce, one other question, and I don't know if you know the answer to this or not, but do you know if insurance companies are still asking any questions at all about the COVID vaccine?
I have not run into that we're in 2024. I would say since the end of 2021, I do not. The one thing that they have done is, and this is minor and it's not even going to affect most of our listeners, although I think Fritz is from outside the United States. We used to be able to do contracts on people from outside of the U.S. if they had hard assets in the United States, such as a business or real estate. Now they eliminated that during COVID, and they have not reinstated it. I actually reached out to three of our closest mutual companies this last week, and all three of them said they have no knowledge of taking that bringing that program back in the near future.
That is interesting.
Yeah. There's a variety of reasons they gave me. One was because they still believe that there is some problems in certain countries of how they responded to a pandemic. So they're not talking about the COVID pandemic, but what happens if there's other pandemics and they don't respond properly. The second thing is that we're getting more and more wars across the globe again, like it used to be, instead of being a much calmer situation. So there's a lot of unrest across mm-hmm. the world, and they want to feel like that's going back down again before they open it up. At least that's what one underwriter told me.
Yeah, that's very, very interesting. And I mean, if you were concerned about the COVID vaccine affecting insurability or your underwriting, it sounds like at this time, if you're in the U.S., they're not, it doesn't matter either way.
No.
Okay, so another question that is really relevant to this, that you mentioned somebody going through underwriting who is age 70. I think a lot of times people lump themselves into this uninsurability question as soon as they hit a certain age, and whatever that certain age is to them, they say, I'm probably too old. And I know this is not the exact conversation today that Nelson is addressing, but Bruce, what would you say to that person who is 70? And I know we've had this conversation, we've had a whole podcast on this before, but just in a quick snapshot in time, just because we probably have new listeners on this particular episode today. What if they said, well, I think I'm uninsurable just because I'm probably too old for insurance? What would you say to that person who might be interested in infinite banking, but maybe in their 70s?
Yeah, that's a great question. I just had to deal with this week. A lady, 70 years old, in Maryland. She said, I'd like to do it on my kids because I'm 70. And I'm like, well, once again, all they really do is they lower the death benefit. Now, the cash value is affected a little bit. However, older people actually get higher dividends as a percentage of their premium. Why? Because the endowment, where the age at which the cash value and the death benefit must meet is age 121. So the time value of money is less when you have an older person. So a 70-year-old only has 51 years to get there. So they have to have a bigger slice of the pie to get there, where a 20-year-old, their dividends will be much, much smaller. However, those dividends that they receive will now actually compound and get a dividend on that dividend, and then a dividend on that dividend. And so that will actually compound, and that exponential curve will actually catch up later on and really accelerate at the end. So if you're 70, I mean, the oldest I've ever done anybody was 74. I did my own father at age 71. So I would say if you're, you can do it all the way up to age 80, and there are some reasons why you may want to do that. I would say the biggest reason is to turn tax deferred money, pay the taxes, put it into a contract, and then you can pass it on to the next generation tax free, even though the cash value and death benefit wouldn't be that great. But as a 75-year-old and below, I would say you should always explore it on yourself. I tell people all the time, listen, it would be much better to do it on you as an older person close to mortality, so that the next generation can benefit from the death benefit, tax-free death benefit, if possible.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're going to talk about...
Which is always going to be tremendously higher than the premiums that you paid in.
It's going to be leveraged up. I don't know, as a 70 or 75-year-old, I don't know what the word tremendously higher means.
Sure.
But So it might only be, let's say you have, as a 71-year-old, you might have a $50,000 cash value, but a $75,000 death benefit.
Okay. So closer. They're closer to meeting earlier in the contract because
they have to, because they have to meet at age 21.
Age 121. Yes. Yeah. Okay. So there's a lot to cover here. I think that was a really good conversation. Fritz, thank you for jumping in. And I think we'll come back to your questions in just a second. But let's go ahead and jump back into the conversation here, where Nelson is laying out, what if I am uninsurable? So we've kind of helped you navigate that conversation of thinking you might be uninsurable. Oftentimes you are not uninsurable. And in fact, you can get insurance and infinite banking still makes sense for you. So remember that first. But what if you, in fact, are not insurable? You have gone through the process, you went through underwriting, you get back that notification that says, no, I'm sorry, you cannot get insurance. What can you do then? You still want to use infinite banking and you want to be able to move forward. And so that's really what Nelson is laying out here. And I do want to point out that he I think this is a really great topic at the beginning of his chapter. So he's talking about a guy, the father, he calls him father, is a 50 years old and is uninsurable or highly rated, meaning he doesn't want to put insurance on himself. He thinks it's not going to be beneficial to do so on account of occupation or poor health. He wants to adopt the infinite banking concept to provide passive income at his age 70 for the balance of his life. And then he cuts in here and he says, please note that I did not say retirement income. I'm dropping that word from my vocabulary.
Yeah.
Passive income is money that comes in every year and you don't have to do anything to receive it. In fact, you can't do anything about it. It just appears. So I love Nelson's very strong stance against the idea of retirement and quitting work and stopping all income and relying on not having to work or choosing not to work and having that be a goal to reach. And so Nelson is really saying having passive income or income that comes from a source other than your job earnings. But I love that he brings that up here at the top of this chapter. Bruce, then he goes in and says, mother agrees this is a worthy goal. So his wife, the father's wife, she's about the same age as her husband, and they have a 23-year-old daughter, Jill, who's in excellent health. And then to accomplish their goal of getting infinite banking in place, they decide to put a $20,000 per year policy on Jill. The numbers are not really that important, but what they do highlight here is that it is a different design. They talk about half PUA and half base premium, and they're putting this on their 23-year-old daughter in this case and saying, okay, well, just because you can't get insurance doesn't mean you can't insure somebody else in your family who you have insurable interest on. And the reason I put that caveat is who you have insurable interest on. You can't just go buy insurance on your neighbor or the president or a person you're not related to, but you can purchase, you can be the owner of a life insurance policy with the insured being somebody that you have an insurable interest in, meaning if they passed away, that somehow you would financially have a challenge or your financial situation would be worse if they were no longer living.
Yeah, let's clarify this. So the underwriting rules have changed slightly since Nelson wrote the book. And so although this is possible, a child that is not a minor, it's really difficult to get a normal insurable interest on them. The underwriters do not, there's an emotional loss, but at age 23, there's not going to be a financial loss in the situation. And there are ways around this. You can sometimes prove to the underwriter, yes, but this particular daughter is in charge of our trust and she's going to help us manage our trust to pay out in our elderly years where maybe we cannot make good decisions. And so if she's not around, then that will actually be detrimental to us. I've done some cases like that. But the best way in these, in today's underwriting world, not the Nelson underwriting world, but today's underwriting world, is you would simply have the 23-year-old get the insurance based upon their own application, their own income, so on and so forth. Then the one or two things could happen. At the time of payment, the 23-year-old can simply make the payment and then get reimbursed by mom and dad. Or most companies have what they call a third party payee. So mom and dad can still make the payment. And then the other way that some people like to do it is once it's actually issued, you can actually change the ownership from the daughter to one of the parents or both the parents or to the parents' trust, because the owner of a policy, once it's issued, can always change ownership and they can always change the beneficiary. So there's a couple of little tricks that you can do to get around the underwriting, which are perfectly, I mean, I've been told this by underwriters, that you could do it like that, because it's by contract, you can do it. So they're not going to not tell you about it. So just keep that in mind, because a lot of people are surprised. They're like, I can't get insurance on my 33-year-old. I don't understand it. You know, logically it kind of makes sense. But then when you look at it logically from the insurance company, why do you, what kind of financial burden is your 33-year-old's death? Now, one thing you could say to them is, hey, they have three kids, and if he passes away, I am not going to let my grandkids not have a good financial life. So I will be responsible. I feel responsible to pay for their upbringing, their colleges, you know, help them start a business, so on and so forth. So that's the insurable interest. That used to be a good thing to argue with an underwriter. They don't see it as much anymore because they say, well, what we really want to see is, hey, why isn't a parent taking responsibility for getting insurance?
Yes.
And if they're not taking good responsibility for, then are they really taking care of the rest of their life, their financial life, their health, so on and so forth? So with the increased analytics, the underwriters have changed what they consider insurable interest. So I do want to point out, Rachel, you already did that. This particular design is a 50-50 base PUA design, which a lot of people who are detractors of Nelson Nash and said that they have found the holy grail in how you do this. Nelson was always saying that you have to do specific designs for each specific person. So here's another great example.
You know, Bruce, the other interesting thing to note about that is that if you are thinking that you need to be the owner of the policy in order to use it, just think about your family dynamics. So for instance, if you wanted to be able to access and use the policy and be able to take out loans yourself, then yes, you need to be the owner. However, if you're in a position where you have a great relationship with your son or daughter who you're able to, they put the policy on themselves, they are the owner, they have access to the cash value. But if you would be in a situation where you are helping fund that policy or you're paying them so that they can make the premium payments and you would then maybe they would feel comfortable with taking out a loan for you for your financial needs. You can work that out within your family dynamics as well, not necessarily having to change ownership in order to have access. And That's just the simple nature of family banking as well, especially if you are having policies that you're not thinking of in your family just as benefiting one individual. You're thinking of them as benefiting the family.
Yes. Okay, so let's talk about now what happened. So they put it on the daughter. They're paying, the parents are paying the $20,000. And of course, the net cash value is increasing every year. The dividends are increasing every year. The death benefit is increasing every year. And then 15 years later, the father is 85 and has drawn out cash values and dividends equal to the premiums paid into the policy. So from 40, she was 43. So that was 20 years later. Nelson's showing them taking out the $28,500 as passive income. What I would point out here is, the daughter could then take over the premium payments at any time. And why would she want to do that? Well, it would increase the cash value for her later. But what Nelson shows is them actually dying, and then the passive income stopping. And the passive income stopping in year 34, where the daughter's 56. So the parents are now gone. They're no longer alive, but she still has the policy. And by the way, in the policy now is $1.1 million of cash value. And so the daughter is still reaping the benefits from this, and she has $2.682 million of death benefit. And Nelson says, that sounds pretty good, doesn't it? And then he also points out that, of course, they could have been using it for banking the entire time, borrowing against the cash value and paying it back, borrowing against the cash value and paying it back. So this is what you can do, is one example of what you can do if you're uninsurable. You could look for a daughter And frankly, they did. You could look at your spouse too.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some limitations there, not on insurability, but there may be some limitations if your spouse makes considerably less money than you do. But all those things can be worked around.
You could even look at a parent. If you, depending on your age and your parents' age, you could look at insuring your parent instead. That's usually something very good to be able to prove insurable interest on, that maybe you're going to be taking care of them financially in their later years. So that is all something that you can look at. And then Nelson even talks about insuring grandchildren, which again is a little bit challenging because you need to prove that the parents have as much insurance as they can get as well. So you can also look at a business partner that you are in business with, that if they had an untimely death, that would impact you and the business as well. So there's a lot of locations or different people that you can look at to put insurance on, and you would be able to use the infinite banking concept by insuring them instead. I do want to point out as well that the way that Nelson set up most of his illustrations and policy examples were a short funding period, no more premium into the policy. And then he talks about utilizing the loan or utilizing the policy for loans that then increases your cash value. And I want to point out that what he is talking about doing, which we've mentioned on multiple of these podcasts before, is that he's talking about taking a loan and paying back additional interest. And so he's saying you're paying yourself interest, you're putting that additional interest into the policy. And because of doing that, you're not actually paying extra interest. You're filling up or adding to the PUAs and putting more premium in. So the point is that the more you capitalize a policy, the more premium that you put in, the higher your cash value is going to perform. So Bruce, is there anything? Oh, go ahead. I was going to say, is there anything you want to cover from the chapter before we answer some questions?
I just like that we have really a lot of questions today, which is awesome. This is one of the reasons we like to do this live. But I just want to wrap this up, this chapter, and then we'll get to the questions from our listeners. I just want to reiterate what I just said. The last couple chapters say, in this illustration, the assumption is that Jill simply let the insurance company manage the policy for the remainder of her life. Therefore, no additional premiums. And at her age 70, she decides in surrender cash value of dividends addition in the amount of $150,000 for the balance of her life. So what's crazy is Jill's going to stop paying, which, once again, there's some reasons why you wouldn't want to do that. But Nelson loved to show this kind of stuff. He would say, look, even if you stop paying, look what happens. And in Jill's case, she could then surrender PUAs in the form of $150,000 for the balance of her life. So now she has a tax-free passive income stream when she gets older. And then he says, assume her death is at age 90, and she has withdrawal passive income totaling $3.15 million, and she still delivers $2.378 death benefit to the next generation. Now, once again, I know this may frustrate some listeners. I know it frustrates some people reading the book. The mortality tables, yes, they've gotten better. However, at the end of 2020, the 7702 laws about how much cash value you can put in and keep the death benefit lower actually established lower death benefit to cash value ratios, which is good when you're trying to build up cash value, but it's bad when you're trying to build up death benefit. Mm. So if you get into a situation where you're looking at an illustration, and you're saying, why isn't this illustration matching up with what Nelson said? It's because tax Treasury Department laws have changed on this. So, but Nelson used to always say, you know, it's not about the rates of return. It's not about the numbers. It's about the concept and you being mm-hmm. in control of your capital. And then finally, it says, this is what I said earlier, all during the period of premium payments and withdrawals, Jill could have used the cash to finance automobiles, homes, anything for your imagination. then the results would have been much greater than depicted in the illustration. And Rachel already mentioned that. That means because in Nelson's world, you would actually not be paying the premiums out of pocket. You would be paying the premiums back by paying additional interest to your policy, which is simply more premiums. Mm-hmm. Okay. Right. And that gets confusing for people. Absolutely. All Nelson was doing was helping people capture more collateral in their, or capital, not collateral, which it turns into collateral, into their cash value. That's all he was doing.
And all right, Bruce, there's two things I want to point out from this chapter before we jump into questions. Yeah. Is that okay with you?
Yeah, of course.
Okay. So one thing that I really love that I just want to highlight to you is that Nelson shows this person in generation one funding a policy on generation two. Then he shows how generation one is able to use this policy, which you can do, as we talked about, creatively, depending on who's the owner of the policy. And maybe generation two takes out a loan for generation one to use, depending on ownership structure. But generation one is able to benefit from a policy on generation two. And then the policy still has a death benefit that pays out to generation two's heirs, meaning generation three can benefit from the same policy. And so I love this idea of being able to benefit multiple generations and really think about an entire family's financial structure and improving the entire family's finances with using infinite banking. So I wanted to point that out. And then one other thing is that he brings up this idea of how to get passive income out of a policy. And he simply mentions that you can take a withdrawal up to your cost basis and not have to pay tax on that. What that means is that however much premium you've paid into the policy, you're able to take out in the form of withdrawal and not pay tax. As soon as you take out more than what you've put in premiums, then you do pay tax on that. You also can take out a policy loan and there's no tax on a policy loan. So,
right, let's just clarify that. So we're not suggesting that you take out more than what the cost basis is.
Correct.
You can do it. We're not suggesting it. We're saying at that point, then you just would switch it from doing withdrawal cost basis to doing a loan from the insurance company. The reason that you would do it that way is if you do it the other way, the compounding, because you're doing this for income now, so you're not paying the loans back. And remember, that seems counterintuitive because Nelson used to always say, don't steal the peas. But that's as you're getting up towards passive income.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. If you steal the peas early, you're never going to get the passive income because you wouldn't have got enough compounding. But once you get to later on where you want to take some passive income, the cash value has grown so much, as long as you didn't steal the peas early, that now when you take a loan, that loan can compound and it will not outpace the compounding of the cash value and dividends. So I just wanted to make that very clear. When you don't, we're not suggesting that, you know, you take out anything above your cost basis, although it wouldn't be the worst thing in the world.
Right. We're not even suggesting that you have to use this for passive income in any stretch of the imagination. You could just use the policy for capitalization purposes and then have the death benefit payout as well. So go ahead, Bruce. I know we have quite a few questions here to address.
Yeah, we do. So JJ, who's a longtime listener, says, so what is the drawback for the insurance company disputing if the client has actual insurance, insurable interest? You know, JJ, that's a really good question because we are normal, rational human beings. Okay. But however, not everybody is. I use this example because it happened in St. Louis where I am. There was a television show called Sweetie Pies. And Sweetie Pies is a series of restaurants in St. Louis where they're owned by this family and they were a reality show. And the uncle took out a $400,000 policy on his nephew. Now, that really doesn't have any insurable interest. However, the uncle was part owner of the restaurant, and the nephew worked in the restaurant. So he could show insurable interest that if the nephew died, he would now have a problem in his business running it properly until he could find somebody to replace his nephew. So that's a legitimate insurable interest. Now, to get to JJ's question, why do you have to jump through all these hoops? Well, even in that case, the uncle was actually caught killing his nephew. So he killed his nephew to get the $400,000.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, you may think that's ridiculous because you're a normal, rational, loving human being. The insurance company does not want to make those evaluations whether you're a rational, normal, loving human being. They are only simply going on numbers. So they know that if a person doesn't have an insurable interest, the likelihood, even if they do, in this case they did, the likelihood could be that there can be some nefarious things going on, much greater than if you had an insurable interest or an emotional interest in that situation.
Oh my goodness.
So I had JJ, no idea unfortunately, about that story. The insurance companies just see you as a number, and they're just using actuarial tables to make these determinations. And remember, mortality is the greatest expense of an insurance company. So they're always going to err on the side of preventing mortality. Mm-hmm. They're always going to err on that side. It's frustrating, but they're always going to do it because it's the one thing that absolutely is going to happen to everybody in our world. You can have homeowners insurance, never have a claim. Mm-hmm. And it is possible to never have a claim. You can have auto insurance and never have a claim. But if you have whole life insurance, you're going to have a claim. You're going to have a claim before mortality, at mortality, or after mortality, but they're going to have a claim. It's a long-term liability. Great question, JJ. And then you, JJ also said, would you call the bankable death benefit or would you call that bankable death benefit for description purposes? Yeah, I think that's great. You can think about that as the death benefit is part of what you're borrowing against as collateral. So it's being a part of the banking process. And then this one's a little bit more difficult. So two, I believe, mm-hmm. is his name. It says, I'm 60 with chronic AFib heart arrhythmia. Would I qualify? Two, I tried to give you an answer on that. It's really difficult to diagnose people over the phone or through text. I'm going to say that it's difficult, but not impossible. They're going to have to know how long you had the AFib. When did you start treating the AFib? What are you doing to treat the AFib? What other conditions do you have on your health? But I'm going to tell you right now, anything dealing with the heart is difficult to get qualified for. However, if you do get an offer, I would highly suggest that you take it, even if the numbers don't look great. Because more than likely with AFib, they're gonna have an additional cost to the insurance, so the cash value is not going to grow as greatly than in other scenarios. I have another good question here by Andre. Andre say, explains Nelson's view regarding using banks for lower cost loans. I've seen Chris and Caleb recommending this. Okay, so one of the things that made Nelson Nash great, and everybody listen right now. One of the things that made Nelson Nash great, which I try to model my life about, is he is. And if you're a Ted Lasso fan, he's the ultimate. Be curious, not judgmental. Mm. So Nelson was always curious about why a person thought that way, but he wasn't going to judge whether you did it that way or not. So example, Andre, I think what you're saying is the insurance companies are charging 5.5% for a loan, but you could get a loan from the bank for 3% or 3.75%, which you could. However, Nelson was an Austrian economist, and one of the reasons that he liked bringing the banking to the you and me level is he was trying to get more and more capital out of banks. Because if we got more and more capital out of banks, banks would have to actually be more sound with their money. And also, when you're borrowing money from a bank, you're just increasing the actual fractional reserve banking in our country and creating money out of thin air. So if you remember, Nelson said, think long term. Don't be afraid to capitalize. Don't steal the peas. Don't do business with banks. Okay, that was one of his tenets. And rethink your thinking. But when I actually felt guilty because I had a mortgage of 2.875, and I'm riding down the elevator in Birmingham, Alabama with Nelson, and I said, Nelson, I understand everything you're saying, and you told me you didn't get the banks out of your life for several years, and I'm still trying to do it, and I have it out of my life with everything but my mortgage. You know, I don't use a bank for anything else to finance except my mortgage. I said, and other people are saying to me, you know, it doesn't make any sense for me to get rid of my mortgage at 2.875. And I'll never forget this. He said, well, Bruce, then don't do it. If it doesn't make sense to you, then don't do it. So, Andre, the first thing I would say is, if it doesn't make sense to you, don't do it. Do use the bank. However, I want to talk about the pitfalls of using the bank. First of all, you have to actually, in most cases, assign your cash value to get those low interest rates. And in most cases, they don't allow you to assign a portion of your cash value. You have to assign your entire cash value. So if you want a $50,000 loan, you're going to have to assign your entire $50,000 or your entire contract to the bank.
If you're using your life insurance cash value as collateral.
As collateral. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's the first thing. Then as you have to pay the loan on their terms. So you don't have a choice of saying, I only want to pay $100. And they're saying, no, you have to pay $350 a month. So you're paying on their terms. The next thing is you can't change those terms. You can't say, oh, this month I don't have $350. I only have $100. I'm just going to pay $100. They're going to say, no, you're in breach of contract. The next thing is most of those loans, and many people found this out, that most of those loans had adjustable rates. So I had two clients, even after telling them the pitfalls, they actually did this. And this is why I'm so adamant about this, Andre. They assigned their cash values to the bank to get 3.75 loans so that they could go buy some rental property. Guess what? As interest rates went up, those were actually variable. And they went up over the cost of the insurance company's loans. So in both of these cases, I'm not saying it's like this with every bank, but both of these cases, they said, we want to pay off the loan with our insurance policies, and we'll just take the insurance company's interest rate now. And you know what the bank said in both cases? That's great, but we're not releasing the cash value for you to use it to pay off the loan. Because as soon as we release it, we no longer have collateral for the loan. And you could just use the cash value somewhere else. And we don't have anything that's backing this loan. So these people had to come up with the money from an outside source to pay off the loan, to release their cash value so that they can then replace it and get the loan from the bank. So don't do business with banks if you don't want to mess with that kind of stuff. That's how simple it is.
What's really interesting about this as well is just say you have $300,000 of cash value in your policy, and now you want to figure out how you're going to get capital for, an investment deal. Just because you have the cash value available in your policy doesn't mean you have to use it. And maybe Nelson would have advocated in most cases using the policy loan. But let's just say policy loan is 8% interest that you're going to pay, 2%. Now,
Rachel, can you repeat that? Because you actually cut out on my end. Cut out with everybody else too.
Okay. I'm giving kind of a ridiculous example that probably wouldn't exist, but just for the sake of the discussion, say you have cash value. You've got $300,000 in cash value in your policy. You want to go take capital for a loan to buy a rental property. And you have an 8% loan option inside your life insurance policy, or you can get 2% interest if you get another loan. So you're looking at the comparison of interest rates. And now Nelson says, don't look at interest rates. We don't want to make decisions based on that rate of interest. But what is interesting to note is that if you get the conventional loan, and not use your life insurance at all, but you get the conventional loan, you're going to have a fixed payment, as Bruce just mentioned. You're also going to be beholden to pay back on their terms, and you're going to have the balance or the bulk of the interest is going to be paid up front, which is where you have that drain out of your control. However, you have more options. The fact that you have life insurance cash value doesn't mean you always, always, always need to use that for every financing decision, but you have more options. Maybe you want to keep that capital available because you have something else you're looking at purchasing or using that for, and so you go secure another loan or you pay cash on a smaller scale for something else because you want to keep this capital in your policy available that you plan to use shortly. There's a lot of things that you can do, and the real truth of the matter is that having the life insurance doesn't mean you would be a purist in saying we always use this. However, you can say that you have more options, which gives you much more control to make decisions. You're not forced into just doing things one way.
Yeah. I find it interesting. People are always trying to compare the lending costs to the dividends and talking about arbitrage and all this other stuff. And some of the most successful real estate investors actually use private hard money to actually purchase real estate at 12 to 15% for their down payments. And if they're successful paying 12 to 15% for capital, I don't understand why you're worried about whether a life insurance interest rate is 5.5% or 5%. I mean, people actually try to do spreadsheets on this stuff. And this is why Nelson said the interest rates don't matter. It's actually having access to capital. That's mm-hmm. why these real estate investors all the time, they don't care they're paying 12 or 15%. They want access to capital because once they have access to capital, they can put it into this investment. They can, in a relatively short period of time, they can harvest either the cash flow to pay back that, or they can do a cash out refinance, or do a flip where they get the cash and pay back the capital. It's short term, so they don't care what the interest rate is. It's the access to capital that's important. So just mm-hmm. remember that. We get caught up, and Rachel, you and I do it too on occasion. You know, we talk about, you know, the dividend rate and the borrowing rates and so on and so forth. But when it comes down to, it's really your capital has to lay somewhere, and it's access to capital that actually gives you the greatest feeling in the world when it comes to safety, security, and taking advantage of opportunities when they pop up.
Which Fritz just mentioned, Robert Kiyosaki, and yes, having access to OPM, other people's money, which when you have life insurance and you have your cash value, the reason that you have access to OPM or other people's money is that you're not taking out your cash value. You're borrowing against it using the insurance company's money. And that's really what gives you that advantage and that leverage. So
yeah, there's a great, I would like to say though, Fritz, there's a great interview by Jason Lowe, who's an authorized practitioner out of Canada, and Nelson Nash on YouTube. And maybe Rachel, I'll get that for you. You can put it in the notes. And yeah. Nelson says, yes, the leverage component from a bank is really, really good until it's not. Nobody talks about when the lever swings the other way. And Nelson jokes, that's what a lever is. It swings one direction and the other direction. So you do have to be in a position of good liquidity for when that lever can actually swing to the other direction. And that's when I find, and if there's any real estate people listening right now, I'm not trying to offend you. However, this is what I find with real estate people is they don't think it's ever going to be a problem. They're always going to figure out a way. And our good friend James Nethery always says it's never a problem until it's a problem. And we saw this in 2008. We're seeing it kind of right now with the housing market frozen up. So don't get yourself over leveraged. And that's what Nelson was talking about with not only the fractional reserve banking, but he's also talking about don't do business with banks. It's a very comfortable way to live your life because they can't change the terms or your money isn't locked up in a particular situation that they control. So,
you know,
this has been a great conversation.
This has been. I'm going to land the plane here. We're a little bit over our time frame that we normally do episodes within an hour, but I want to just give a quick plug to a book I'm reading. I cannot remember the author's name. I'm listening to it. I'm about 2 hours into a 15-hour book called Why We Sleep. And I think it's by a PhD. And what's very, very interesting is that sleep alone accounts for the ability of our bodies to repair and heal and be not in a chronic condition of health problems. And so what I think is extremely valuable is sleep. We all kind of think that we can medicate and do pills and that all of those things are really important when sleep actually turns out that it's one of the number one things that you can do to improve your health. And so if you are looking to become more insurable and improve your health, I would suggest checking out that book. So Why We Sleep. And again, I don't have the author's name in front of me. Thank you so much for being with us on this podcast. We still have a few more episodes before we're done with this book. So I'm not willing to tell you how many episodes will be in this series yet, because there's a lot of great stuff that he's got right here at the end. And so we will continue on until we feel that we're complete with covering Nelson Nash's work. So if you have questions about this book, Becoming Your Own Banker, we'd love to hear them. You can drop them into the comments on the live stream here, or if you are listening after the fact, you can drop the comments into YouTube or Facebook or LinkedIn or Twitter, wherever you're listening, so that we can see those questions and address them in future episodes. You can also email us at hello@themoneyadvantage.com with your questions that we can bring up on a future show. And we love your feedback and input that way. And if you are ready to get started with infinite banking or add on to policies, or you have a policy right now that you're not sure how to use well, we would love to hear from you and talk with you about how to do that and how to do infinite banking in a way that's going to serve you best in your financial life. And you can book a call with our advisors at themoneyadvantage.com, get on our calendar, and figure out how to make infinite banking work best in your life. So thank you for being with us on this show. Thank you for being just willing to ask the questions and for listening in. And please share this with somebody else that you feel would be benefiting from learning how to take control of their finances and thinking differently. So with that, please remember, success leaves clues. So model the successful few, not the crowd, and build a life and business you love. We'll see you next time.
Discover the secret of how to earn a return on the same money in two places at the same time so that you can strengthen your investment returns. We've created a free guide for you that explains the top three things every investor needs their privatized banking system to do. Go to themoneyadvantage.com/banking, put in your name and primary email address, click the Send My Free Guide button right now, and we'll see you on the inside.